you're one way out of the book in here. Yeah, I knew that. Is that what it is? You're supposed to be broadening your mind for this focus. I used to take the book as being ways to find out if I ever had to learn a subject, and I remember writing a lot of them off. Like there was a book in. Yeah.
In my class, you only have dibs on the room that's 5 feet.
And the previous dibs isn't mine, eh? It's, the previous dibs.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. All right. So. So remember where we are. Any questions about where we are? This is probably today is probably the most important part of the whole thing. So it's power cutting. So you remember the framework. Let's take this to the start in our toy model. We had a what you might call a microscopic. Theory was the theory including both the very high energies and the low energies, so it included the short distance physics. We had a Lagrangian, which was had two fields in it. And they each had masses. And then they had these various interactions. We had, you know, minus 1 over 4 factorial. I won't write them all down. And then the low energy or the macroscopic. Was this Wilson action? And that was basically an arbitrary Lagrangian built out of L, invariant under symmetry, L goes to minus L. We had built in the symmetry of this microscopic thing, so that was minus 1/2. In general, we could have had some potential. So let me do that first. So if we start off with the potential, we could have had A plus, I guess let's call it little a. I had A naught, A2 L squared over 2, A4 L over 4 factorial. So we had all the various things with no derivatives, and then we had things with two derivatives. I think I called that B, right? I had B. And the rule here was we were just writing down all possible things that were local polynomials of L and its derivatives subject to the symmetry L goes to minus L, because we knew that that's a property of the full theory this is supposed to capture. And the last class, I was giving a prescription for how to figure out what each of these coefficients was. And what that prescription was the matching. So the coupling, the effective coupling, and so the idea was we calculate something, and I use the example of the one light particle irreducible generating functional, but it could have been the L scattering rate, or just any physical thing that gets a contribution from the parameter you're interested in. You calculate it in this theory to some order in whatever you think is small. You do the same calculation to the same order in this theory, and then you demand that whatever this coefficient is, it's the one that gives you the right answer to the order you're working in Because I'm fixed ordering one over the heavy mass. So remember we had little M was much smaller than big M. And we're thinking of doing an expansion of one over M. So we require A naught, etc. to be whatever is required. Reproduce full result for a set of physical observables. Some fixed order in 1 over capital M and possibly G left or whatever the other parameters are in the problem. But certainly one of some fixed order in 1 over M. We needed to work at some fixed order in 1 over M because it was only then that we were going to be able to capture the physics in terms of some local polynomials of the fields and the derivatives. So we were guaranteed that this was going to be possible. I mean, the question was just reading off what these things are. And what we get for these things will depend on what order we're working. So there'll be, you can imagine all these coefficients being some series in 1 over M, G sub L, and whatever. That would be required to capture the effects of the heavy particles order by order in all these small things that you might be perturbing in. So that's how you would, in particular, compute these things. But if you imagine actually, supposing you're interested in a real application, you wanted to calculate scattering at low energies, or you want to calculate, whatever you happen to be interested in. Let's say we're interested in scattering at low energies of these L particles. Then what you're really interested in is not what you're really interested in is what the answer is, and you want to know what the answer is, and you want to know to what the answer is to within some specific accuracy. And so, one problem in the way of phrasing so far is that you don't really know when to stop. If, in principle, if you work to high enough power in 1 over M, this series is going to go out across the board here, and we'll be at 16,000 derivatives over here with some coefficient you could calculate if you wanted to. And the pressing question in practice is, do you need to calculate those terms or not? And whether you need to or not depends on how accurately you want to know the answer. So if you're trying to calculate something to the 1% level, say, then for fixed values of coupling constants and values for these masses, a 1% calculation might require you to work to second order in M over M. Let's say the big mass is 10 times the little mass in the theory of interest. Then to work to 1% order, you'd have to work to order little m over big M squared, or maybe linear order in little m over big M times a coupling constant, which is a tenth or something like that. So if you know how accurately you want to know the answer, that would tell you in a real application how far you wanted to go in the various expansions you're doing, and that would tell you to what accuracy you need to work. And that, in principle, tells you how far down the series you have to go. But the tool that you need to know precisely how far down the series you have to go is what power counting is all about. Because supposing we wanted to work to order 1 over m squared in the answer, we know that there's things like this L squared times dl dl is going to, on dimensional grounds, have a coefficient which goes like 1 over m. And the mass that appears there could very well, in the example we calculated, we got a contribution which was going like 1 over m squared. But we also saw that things that had dimensionless coefficients, say, like this one, had contributions which were of order 1 over m. They had contributions which were not suppressed by powers of 1 over m, but then they had corrections which were also suppressed by powers of 1 over m, the powers of, say, little mass divided by the big mass squared. And so what you want to know to any fixed order in the small thing is exactly how many of these things you have to do this matching calculation for. And so the power counting is all about that. So what we want to do with power counting is we want to take the low energy theory alone, and what we want to ask is, if I calculate to 16,000 loops some Feynman graph with this thing, how many of these terms, how do the answers depend on the parameters in the problem, like big M and little m? And the complicating feature is that although on dimensional grounds we're expecting these coefficients of higher powers of derivatives and fields to be suppressed by powers of 1 over m, if the Feynman loop gives you positive powers of m, then as it can, because these loops can diverge. And so they're sensitive to high frequencies in the loops. The thing you worry about is that the explicit powers of 1 of rem, you know, if you're only interested in the answer to 1 over 1 of rem squared, maybe it's true that you have to keep an interaction to order 1 of rem to the fourth and stick it into a graph which is proportional to m squared, and that might be a contribution which is as big as you're trying to calculate. So it might be that you have to keep things that look like they're smaller than you need in this Lagrangian to get an answer which is where the physical quantity has been calculated to the accuracy you need. And so what you need to know is when you stick interactions like this into a process, how do the positive powers of M come in, and how do they complicate the appearance of these parameters in the final physical answer? So power counting is basically systematic dimensional analysis for Feynman graphs, and it tells you how things scale with the big mass scale. So the question is, since the insertion of an effective interaction which is proportional to 1 over m squared and insert into a Feynman graph complicated. And produce effects enhanced by powers of m squared radius to side, which interactions are relevant fixed order only 1 of rem. So what we have to do is just take some Lagrangian, look at the Feynman rules, and see what we get. So what I want to do is take not exactly this Lagrangian, but I want to take a fairly generic Lagrangian that depends on a bunch of scales. And I'm going to put in more than one scale because I'd like to be able to use the same estimate in a bunch of situations down the road where I can just choose what the scales are conveniently. And so the answer will be here. So suppose our Wilson action was this. It's something, it has the dimensions of mass to the fourth. So let's say we have a scale f to the fourth in front of the whole thing. And then it's a bunch of sums of polynomials of things like powers of fields and stuff like that. So we've got sum over some index, I'll call it K. I won't give it a label. Some interactions. And they depend on the fields. Let me generically call the fields phi. And let me make them a dimensionless function. So I'll imagine it's phi divided by some scale V, which is just some parameter. And so I'm imagining that this is the powers because a field has, I'm imagining here scalar fields, or bosonic fields have dimensions of mass. I'm imagining that this parameter here has dimensions of mass, and this parameter here has dimensions of mass. The dimensions of this interaction won't care about the fields because I've arranged them into dimensionless coefficients, but they will care about derivatives. So if I take an example over here, if I imagine writing an L squared, a term like L squared, dl dl, and I think of L as being, if I write L is equal to L over V times V, then L squared dl dl, I'm imagining writing that as being L over V squared dl over V dl over V times V to the 1, 2, 3, 4. And if I think of this as being the operator, what I'm calling O over there, there's no dimensions in the field anymore because I pulled out a factor of V, but the derivative still gives me dimensions. So this would be an example of an operator which has dimensions of mass squared because it's the derivative. So I'm pulling out this factor of V so that the dimension of the operator is counting the derivatives. And so since I've already got something which has the dimensions of Lagrangian here, I have to choose a coefficient which depends on a mass scale that cancels the dimension here. So let me call this some dimensionless coefficient C sub k divided by some other mass scale m, and it's raised to the dimension of this thing, C sub k. So F, V, and M are arbitrary mass scales. C sub k are dimensionless. And D sub k is equal to the number of derivatives in O sub k. And that's also equal to the dimension of O sub k because of the way I have things fit. And O sub k is some polynomial, or some, not a polynomial, but it's a power of phi over v. And it's derivatives. All at a single point. With some local interaction. So what I want to do is take this generic interaction and see how it appears in Feynman rules. So in Feynman rules means we're doing perturbation theory. I'm imagining that we're using this in a path integral. We're looking at the quadratic piece of the Lagrangian, and that's going to be the unperturbed part of the action. And then all the things involving powers of phi that are larger than 2 will be things that are in the interaction part of the Lagrangian. And so that'll define the vertices. And so in particular, the thing here which has d sub k equals 2 and 2 powers of the field, that'll be the thing that's the kinetic term, if you like. Thing that has d sub k equals... zero, and 2 powers of phi would be like the mass term of the Lagrangian. And so by just taking specific choices of these coefficients, we can identify any term in this Lagrangian. And in particular, I'm going to want to separately identify the kinetic term and from the interaction term. So in particular, put this into a path integral. And separate the quadratic piece. And phi as the unperturbed action. Bring in the rest. Along the lines of what I was describing, you know, in previous lectures. So the unperturbed, so L Wilson naught, if you like, will be terms with D with 2 powers of phi. And the 2 or 0 powers of derivative. So d sub k will be 2 or 0. So now let's just imagine drawing a graph. So we imagine we're going to calculate the Feynman graph with e external lines. some sort of a thing. I don't care what it is, and it has the speed lines coming up. Let's suppose that it has I internal lines. And it'll have a bunch of vertices. And those vertices will come from powers of phi in here that are, say, cubic and higher. We could choose to perturb in, we might decide that some of the masses are small, in which case we could have things in here which are have two powers of phi. In principle, nothing I'm saying here is going to stop us from doing that. But there'll be various kinds of interactions, and they'll depend on which particular operator we're focusing on here. And so they'll have different choices for d sub k. They'll be labeled by how many fields they had, so that'll be how many lines came together at that vertex, and how many momenta they had, so how many powers of derivatives there were in that vertex. Those will be the two things we want to label our vertex with. So we'll have v sub I and k, let's say k and n, vertices involving n fields. And actually, call that D, I guess, to be consistent with these derivatives. Be consistent with what I did over there. So it's something with that brings together n fields. And the Feynman rule for that, if we had been in momentum space, would be some momentum, some power of momentum to the dth power. Or if we're in position space, it'll be some d number of derivatives. P mu to the d schematically. I think that's all I need to tell you. Okay. And let's say that the answer for this, it has some external momentum flowing into it. Let's call the external momentum q. We can do most of the arguments, since the arguments I'm making are dimensional arguments, I'm going to make them in momentum space, but you could do it in position space if you were interested, as long as you're careful about the dimensional analysis, how the dimensional analysis goes through. And so there's nothing fundamental about doing momentum space here, but I'm going to use momentum space because that's what everybody has more intuition about, and so you can see more directly where these powers are coming from. But people often object to that when thinking about gravity and things like that, where you're interested in position-dependent backgrounds, and there's nothing intrinsically momentum space-dependent about what the argument I'm giving. So so whatever this graph is, what we want to do is we're going to calculate the amplitude. So let's say the answer from this graph, we'll call it A. It depends on E external lines, and it depends on whatever the momentum is flowing through the external lines. So where Q is an external momenta. And if we've been in position space, this would be derivatives. We'd be looking, you could think of this as being we're calculating an effective interaction which involves powers of the fields and derivatives. It has E powers of the fields, and it has some number of powers of the derivatives. And in momentum space, that would be some polynomial in the external momentum. All right. And so we're supposed to build this by combining the Feynman rules. So we have that A will be schematically it's going to be what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to have a factor for every loop, every internal line. So every internal line will give us a factor of the propagator, and the propagator would have been minus I, you know, integral, every internal line I'm supposed to do an integral d for momentum, d over some momentum integral. If we're being careful, there'd be a 2 pi to the fourth here, I guess. There's a, normally I would have said here there'd be a 1 over p squared plus m squared, where this is the, and I should say, you should keep in mind here that this could mean a mass. It could be, there could be, the momentum flowing through this line might be not directly a loop momentum. It might involve a loop momentum together with an external momentum. So this P could mean P plus Q. Nothing I'm saying here really relies on that so much. I would have normally written this, but this choice for the propagator, that assumes that our unperturbed Lagrangian was you know, d phi was m squared phi squared, right? But in the Lagrangian we started off with, the thing that had two powers of phi over v, the way I defined it on the board over there that I can display again maybe. I've actually told you how these v's, f's, and everything appear in that that term. So if we take let's take the term with d equals 2 and two fields. So e.g. d equals 2 with two fields. Would give me the kinetic term would have been f to the fourth. I would have had some c, 2 if you like, so some c, let's call it c sub k. I would have had two derivatives, and so I would have had two powers of m, because d sub k would have been 2 over there. Then I would have had derivative of phi over v, derivative of phi over v, the way I wrote it there. So that would have had, that has a coefficient here, which is f to the fourth times c divided by m squared d squared times d phi d phi. So you see I'm carrying around a factor which would not normally be in your kinetic term. And the way I get the propagators from this kinetic term is I'm supposed to take whatever was in the action and invert it, because the propagator is the inverse of the kinetic operator. If we'd had box plus m squared as being our kinetic operator, we would have been led to this as our propagator, 1 over box plus m squared. And so what we have to have, if we invert this thing, we should be getting for every propagator a factor of 1 over this, multiplying the p squared term. So I can write here a factor of m squared v squared over f to the fourth. And if I define my mass with those factors scaled out, then I would have this propagator with, you know, the mass like that. So this is a capital M that was in the Lagrangian. This is, let me call this mu squared. It's the coefficient. What I'd like to do is, for the mass term, which didn't have two derivatives, is to normalize it in the same way. And so instead of having a derivative here, I'd call it mu squared phi squared, but with the same coefficient up front. And that's what I'm calling mu. But all you need to think of is it's some scale which is a low energy scale. And I'm typically going to just ignore it. Yeah, and I ignore all the CKs because those are dimensional factors. I'm thinking they're all order 1, and so I'm not going to keep track of them. My goal is to follow these scales and do the answer. And I'll basically have one of these for every internal line. So it won't be a power, but it'll be products of factors like this. And for every vertex, I'll have factor of I, I'll have a delta function for all the momentum in the vertex. I'll have a coupling constant. You know, I'll have what do you call it? The coefficient like this that's sitting in front of the power of the field will appear as a coupling constant. And so what that will be is I'll have a factor of f to the fourth because that was in the Lagrangian, and then I'll have a factor of 1 over m to the d, where d is the number of derivatives in the vertex, and that's what I'm using d for here. These vertex is labeled by d and n. This is the number of derivatives. So I'll have a 1 over m for every derivative. And I'll have a 1 over v for every field that was in the vertex, which is what I'm calling n. That's it, right? I'll have that basically for every vertex labeled by D and N. And in principle, I got a product over all N and D in the Lagrangian. I think that's all I want to follow. Let me just make sure I haven't missed anything. Oh, and I forgot that there's an explicit power of the momentum. So I should have actually, let me write that this way. Every m came with a derivative, and the derivative will give us a momentum in the vertex. So I'll have p over m to the d. So I should get that. And if I'm being as picky with the 2 pi to the fourth, I should have kept my 2 pi to the fourth. You know. I forgot. It's worth keeping the kappa factor of the 2 pi's because they, if you don't keep track of the 2 pi's, it makes a difference. You know, if you thought of the electromagnetic perturbation theory being powers of the electric charge, then you would think it's a really bad approximation to do perturbation theory in electromagnetism because the electric charge E in fundamental units is 0.3 or something. What you're really doing in a series of in electromagnetism is alpha over 4 pi, where alpha is a Planck structure constant, E squared over 4 pi. And so that's something, you know, alpha is the thing that's 1 over 137, and so alpha over 4 pi is 10 to the minus 3. So the series in electromagnetism is a really good series because it's really a series in E squared over 16 pi squared. But it's the 16 pi squared that are doing all the work for you. And E squared is 0.1. And so keeping track of these 2 pi's is actually important in practice when you're deciding how small things are in the perturbation theory. So that's why I'm keeping them. So I got that right. And so I'm good, I think. Now, the usual story is that we're doing a bunch of integrals. We've got a bunch of delta functions. The delta functions will do some of the integrals. And you remember that all these delta functions are used to do integrals except for one. Because the one thing we know is that the whole answer has to be proportional to a delta function, which doesn't involve any loop momenta. It just expresses conservation of four momenta for the external momenta. And so once we're finished, this whole thing will be equal to what we could call the reduced amplitude. Let's write A to B of Q as being 2 pi to the fourth times this delta function we know has to be there, involving only external momenta, times some reduced thing. Let's call it A bar V Q. And what will happen is that when we actually do evaluate the integrals and do the keep track of the delta functions there, in practice what will happen is that these delta functions, they're only inside the integration as long as they depend on loop momenta, and there'll always be one once you do this process, which will end up not depending on the loop momenta, which will come out front, and that'll be the one we're going to explicitly identify as being the conservation of four momentum delta function. So what's left is going to schematically, it's going to look like we're going to have, you know, I'm not going to keep track of the i's. We'll keep track of the 2 pi's. But we're going to have an integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth. And we're going to have basically one of these for every internal line. We'll have, m squared d squared over f to the fourth, 1 over p squared plus mu squared, the number of internal lines. The delta functions, we're going to have I 2 pi to the fourth, delta functions involving four momenta and external momenta. We'll have that to the number, have that for each vertex, so we have to sum over all the possible vertices. But we have one of them has been explicitly extracted here, so we'll have, you know, minus one plus this. And then the other loop factors just are going along to the ride, so we'll have product over D and N. D over M to the B. So I've just grouped the terms. So now what I want to do is all these next thing I want to do is that these parameters I and the number of vertices and the number of external lines, they're not all independent of one another. Because this is the way you construct graphs, tells you that every line has to end at a vertex, and every vertex connects lines. And so there's topological identities that relate those numbers. So we might as well use those identities to eliminate, to keep track of only the things that are things that we can separately vary. So there's two identities which relate these things. Identities relate E, I, and V in any graph. The first one is just conservation of n's. That just says there's two ways of counting the ends of lines. It's the sum of the ends that arrive at a vertex somewhere, or it's two for every internal line and one for every external line. So the number of ends of lines is equal to one for every external line plus two for every internal line, plus also equal to the sum over all the vertices of the number of vertices with d derivatives and n lines, but n here is counting how many lines ended at that vertex, so I should multiply by n. And this is counting the ends that arrive at a vertex. This is counting the ends by the number of lines that were there. So this identity relates the number of external lines and internal lines to the number of vertices. That's the first one. Second one is a definition. Of the number of loops. So to motivate that definition, first think about if you think about drawing a Feynman graph on the board, so if you think about a typical graph like you might have drawn, that's a simple one, like that one, say. This graphs like this have a property. Let's just take some examples here. These have the property that if I take the number of, I can count the number of loops. What we mean by loop in this kind of graph is obvious, right? It's just the number of times I've got a space in here surrounded by a line. Let's call out the number of loops for this kind of graph. This kind of graph has the property that if I take the number of loops defined by the number of faces here, minus the number of edges here, the number of lines, so the number of internal lines, and plus the number of vertices, so sum over all the vertices, number of vertices, that's always equal to 1. So in this case, L would have been 2. I would have had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines, internal lines, and I would have had 1, 2, 3, 4 vertices. That's 6 minus 5 is 1. In this case, I would have had 1, 2, 3, 4 faces. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 lines. And I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 vertices. So I've got 13 minus 12 is 1. And so what's going on there is the topology that if you take a two-dimensional surface and you triangulate it with things like this, you just take it as being a bunch of vertices which are connected by lines, then the number of faces minus the number of edges plus the number of corners of these triangulations is equal to the Euler number of whatever that surface was. So if you had done a disk, which is what we're doing here, the Euler number of a disk is 1. But if you'd done a sphere, you would have gotten 2. And if you'd done a torus, you would have gotten 0. And if you did whatever you wanted to do, any two-dimensional surface would have had this sum would have been always giving you the Euler number of that surface. And so what we'll do is as long as we're drawing graphs that are like this, that you can draw on a plane, we could define the number of loops to be the obvious thing, it's the number of loops. But if you had a graph which you can't draw on a plane, so if we had a graph like this one, let's say a graph here, where we have a line, and then another line goes through, but it doesn't intersect this one, it kind of goes over it and connects over here, I couldn't draw that on a plane. And that's why I had to do this funny thing of where this line actually came over top. This is something which, if I take the number of faces here, it's not obvious what a face is, because it's not in the plane. So what I'll do in this case is I'll define the number of loops to be this. So to repeat that, any graph that you can draw on a plane, the obvious thing of what you mean by loop would have been satisfying this all the time. But what we'll do is we'll, for any Feynman graph, we'll define the number of loops by this formula. And for a graph like this where it's not obvious what a loop is, this is telling you what the number of loops is. So the definition is L is 1 plus the number of internal lines minus the sum of all the vertices. And that's the definition. And it agrees with your intuition in the simple graph that you would normally draw. So now what I'd like to do is take these definitions and get rid of I, because what we're looking for is how the answer depends on these scales. And we can follow E, because that's something we get to specify in the graph. So we'd like to hold on to that as an answer. And I'd like to trade off as much as possible these and I's for things that I can keep track of more systematically. And so I'll use this to get rid of I, let's say. And then I can use this one to get rid of some of the vertices. And I like to express things in terms of L, because you'll see that L is actually a useful quantity in Feynman graphs. It controls how many integrals you're doing, for instance. That's one way to see why this is a useful definition. If we ask how many integrals are left after we've used the delta functions to do some of them, you can see that the number of integrals left will be the number of internal lines minus 1 plus the sum of the vertices. And that's minus the number of loops. Is that, did I do that right? What happened there? I.
And minus the other thing, which minus.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so let me write that carefully. L is useful because, among other things, it counts number of integrals that need doing after the delta functions are used up. So number of integrals was one, we started with I, and we subtract one for every delta function. And we had it, the number of delta functions was the sum of all the vertices minus 1. Minus 1 because one of them survives as the overall momentum conservation delta function. That's 1 plus I minus the sum of the number of vertices plus L. So schematically, we've got integral. And the 2 pi went along for a ride for that, right? We had 2 pi to the fourth here for every delta function. We had 1 over 2 pi to the fourth for every I. And so the 2 pi's are going to be counting kind of by L's as well. So we're going to d4p over 2 pi to the fourth, basically to the L power. Then we have these explicit factors of constants. So actually, why don't we write those first? So we had that. For every vertex, we had f to the 4 for every internal line, we had m squared d squared over f to the 4. Then we have the number of loops. We had integral d4p over 2 pi to the 4 to the L. And then the integrand for every 2 squared plus mu squared, the number of internal lines. And then we had P over M for the number of B times V Dn. I should be taking a product here now over all vertices. We had f to the fourth divided by v to the n, the number of vertices. Have I got everything? I've got that, I've got that, I've got that, I've got that, I've got that. Good. So now the next thing is we're going to have to do an integral here. And so here's where the dimensional analysis comes in. So this is some multi-dimensional integral. It's not a one-dimensional thing. But what I want to do is I want to think of all the, what's a low energy scale and what's a high energy scale. And these V's, the M's, and the F's were things that were in the Lagrangian. And we've seen from the example, the explicit example where you're calculating things, it tends to be that the big mass is appearing everywhere it can. When we calculate this Wilson action, what it's doing is it's replacing the effects of the heavy physics in the low energy theory. Effects due to light loops are in the low energy theory too, because the Wilson action and the full action both had light loops. The thing that the Wilson action doesn't have that the full theory had is the heavy particles. And so these effective interactions are all capturing the effects of the heavy particles. And so those effects are tended to be characterized by the heavy particle mass. And so on dimensional grounds, we were typically finding that when we integrated out a heavy particle, we were getting all these effective interactions with scales, with coefficients that were being set by the powers of the mass that we integrated out. So I want to be thinking of these Fs and these Ms and these Vs as typically being big scales. And I'm not going to pin down yet what they are. But I'm thinking of them as being bigger than these external momenta, Q, and whatever the masses were of the light particles, because every propagator in here is a light particle, because this is being done with the Wilson action. So I want to think about mu being of the order of Q, and both things being much lighter than these other things, than like capital M, V, and F. And if you look at it, all the powers of the big scales are explicit factors up front, and the integrals depend in a complicated way on variables, those variables being the external momenta and the masses in the loop. But those are all light scales inside the integrals. So whatever this integral is, it's going to be dimensionally some power of one of those light scales. And so I'm not going to keep track of separately. I'm not going to keep, I'm going to assume that these things are the same size. If there's a hierarchy of scales in the light theory, then you have to work harder than what I'm doing now. But if all these scales are the same size, all the upshot is that this integral will be given by the appropriate power on dimensional grounds of this light scale. And then the rest of these big scales will go along for the ride. And when I'm done, I'm going to have dimensionally a correct answer, which is dimensionally correct, because all I've done is I've taken this integral and replaced it by the light scale that was the appropriate power to capture the dimension of the integral. And this is a step which would have been wrong if we have been cutting this integral. These integrals are diverging typically, right? We're going to typically find that the integral as p goes to infinity is not converging. And if we cut the integral off, then the dimensional analysis argument would have been still true, but it's the largest scale in the integral which should be the thing that's capturing the size of the integral. And so the argument I'm about to make, I could still make, but what would appear in this answer would be the cutoff to the power that I'm going to raise the small scale to. And so that would not be an incorrect statement. It would be saying that the dimensional analysis level of estimating a cutoff integral is dominated by the cutoff, and it's going to identify for you the most important cutoff dependence. But the one thing you knew about that cutoff dependence in the Wilson action was that that was canceling in the answer, because it was then going to cancel something. All the cutoffs that were in the coefficients, these Fs, Vs, and Ms would also depend on the cutoff, and there'd be a conspiracy to make those cutoffs cancel one another, because the cutoff doesn't appear in the final answer that we're calculating. So it wouldn't be a very useful argument to make for the purposes of trying to see where the heavy physics and the light physics appear in the answer. And that's where dimensional analysis, dimensional regularization is really useful. So what I'm imagining doing now is I'm going to dimensionally regularize all these integrals. And when I dimensionally regularize them, you saw last class, there will be a scale that appears, but it only appears logarithmically. The scale, you remember, arises because all the coupling constants have different dimensions and different dimensions, different engineering dimensions and different space-time dimensions. And so if I scale out a power of some random scale mu to make them have the dimensions they have in four dimensions, you need two words for dimensions here. That always appears logarithmically because they're always taking the number of dimensions to four. And so in dimensional regularization, it's specifically true that these integrals, when I evaluate them, they'll be positive, they'll be the appropriate power of the light scale. And it's only in that case that the argument I'm making would go through, strictly speaking. So that's why I was kind of making a big deal about, one of the reasons I was making a big deal about dimensional analysis in dimensional regularization. All right, so let me write that. I want to keep that property, and I guess I can keep that some. We will regularize all integrals using dimensional regularization. Then the integrals evaluate to a power of the light scales E and Q set by dimensional analysis. At the accuracy I'm working where, I'm just trying to follow where the powers of masses go through. And so we can read off what that is here. We're going to get the integral d4p to pi to the fourth to the L 1 over p squared plus, let me just write, I'll just, I won't keep, I'm thinking of these things as being the same size, so I'll just write q. But whenever you see q, it could be a derivative or it could be a mass to the number of internal lines. And I'll just keep it was p to the d. That's the stuff that depends on the integral. So what I'm going to do is I'll. So how many powers of q do we have? We have q. We had 4l. And we had this to the number of. We had product over all the vertices of p to the d times the number of vertices of that property. So we have 4l. Minus 2i plus sum over all the vertices of d and v of d. And then the two pi's we can follow as well. So we're going to get face value, we're going to get 2 pi to the fourth to the number of, 1 over 2 pi to the fourth to the number of loops. But it's also true that there's an angular integral in the d4p. And schematically, if you thought of integral d4p, if nothing here depended on angles, if we were just, if supposing it would really have the integral like this that depended only on p squared, if we had a function of p squared here, then this, we could have written as, p cubed dp times some angular integral. And that angular integral would just basically be the volume of a free sphere. If we've been doing this in three dimensions, which is what you normally used to do, this is the volume of a two sphere. And we would have f of p squared. And so this the volume of the three squared is basically 2 pi cubed or something like that, 2 pi squared. And if I go from, if I write integral dp as being p squared dp squared over 2, that tells the 2. And so that 2 with the 2 pi squared would have given me a factor of pi squared. And since I'm counting pi's, I'm going to count that factor of pi. And these 2's are really not so important, but I'm going to I'm going to count every loop as being pi squared divided by 2 pi to the fourth. So let me write that as. So that's 1 over 16 pi squared, the number of loops. That's convenient because that's what typically happens when you actually do loops. Back to where we were. Sorry, that again. I don't want to erase these identities. So. altogether, we're a group what we have so far. We've got one-third, d-squared over f four different lines. We've got 1/16 pi squared the number of loops. We've got product over all the vertices of actually, why don't we just group powers now? Let's so 1/m to b and then f fourth over e to the n. And then I've got the q to the 4L minus 2I plus some to the n. All right, I guess actually that's the way I could write this is b. Wait, let me write this explicitly in the so now I want to use these identities to make things make life easy for myself. So let me make sure I always do this wrong the first time I do it. Let me just maybe just cut to the chase. So the simplest thing, I guess, is to let's first get rid of I, and I want to get rid of I in the smart. The thing to do is to do this in the smart way. So let's write let's eliminate I using I is equal to L minus 1 plus sum over n of b. So then this is not going to be. So minus 2i, what I'll do is, for the minus 2i, I'll use that one up there, I guess. I'll use minus 2i is e minus the sum of n times z. Oh, did I do something wrong there?
That's true. Okay, you have sigma. And
you can play what I wrote or what I wrote, right?
And then you're right.
Okay.
And I send the final.
Okay. Let me write it actually below here so I can. Let me write it again because what will happen is if I erase something, I'll never figure out what I did.
Okay, so it's like minus 2i and the next one. It's cubed 4l plus e.
So what you use is this plus e.
That's all.
Mine. Plus sum of b minus m. Right? All right, so let's go down group check. Group things. We have, let's group all the guys that have an L in them. So, that's probably the thing to do is let's.
So this f to the fourth with a minus one. Let me write the answer down, because if I do this in real time, we'll be here forever, but you'll see what I mean. So it's f to the fourth. This overall f to the fourth is this one with a minus one. And there's a 1/v, the number of external lines, and that's coming from I think I did the wrong choice again. I think I wanted to. There's one relationship between L and the vertices, which I get by limiting I between those two equations. That's the one I haven't used yet. So let me tell you the answer then. That's m q over 4 pi F squared to the 2L. Is 2 over M. 2 plus M over the vertices of K would be minus 2. There's various ways of writing it, and this is a useful way of writing it. But let me make that plausible. I think the thing that's puzzling here is that you get 1 over V to the E. So if I take, the claim is that if I take the total power of V here, let me just follow that one through so you can kind of see what happens. So EG, I had 1 over V to the minus L plus 1 minus the sum over the vertices plus the sum over the vertices times the of that, right? And so this, the claim is equal to E if I eliminate I between those two equations. So let's do that. So I know that I is equal to L minus 1 plus the sum of the vertices. But I also know that E is equal to sum over the vertices of N times V minus 2I. But the sum over the vertices of NV minus 2L plus 2 minus 2 times the sum of the vertices. That's 2 minus 2L. Sum of N minus 2. So what I should have gotten over here if I group things was, boy, that's so close, eh? That's because I forgot the 2 here. So I had minus 2L plus 2 plus twice the number of vertices. And you can see that what I had there is really 1 over E. That's where that came from. So for these other ones, you have to do the same thing. It's what I've done here, just plugging that in isn't going to necessarily give you the power I'm giving you now. But the missing step then is this relationship between, it doesn't involve, this one here doesn't involve I. So you can trade an L for an E using that relationship. And this is kind of the one that's useful to use. And why is it useful to use? Well, let me just say that quickly and then we can take a break. What's great here is that you can see that this has a structure. Remember the original interactions we had, are probably still here. They had the structure that anytime you had an F, everything was proportional to F to the fourth. But here's something which is so what I'm arguing now is that this has the, if you interpret Q as being a derivative, let's say there were no masses, this has the same kind of structure as the terms in the original Lagrangian did. There's an F to the fourth in front of everything. That's not F to the fourth there. And there's no more F except for that one later on. So this is something which is like a telling you how things change as you look at higher loop corrections. The number of V's here that has been extracted corresponds to the number of V's here. There's 1 over V for every power of phi in the answer. If I had had something that directly contributed a vertex with E external lines, which is the thing I've been calculating, that would have been the thing which went like 1 over V to the E. That's that factor. And this is a power of Q over M. If Q were a derivative, that would be like counting the number of derivatives in this interaction. And so this has the structure, the way I've written it, as being something which has the same form of, I could think of it as being a contribution to an interaction which has got the polynomial in the fields and the momenta. The number of fields is the number of fields that we're talking about as external lines. The number of derivatives is something which we can talk about what that thing is in a second. It's some positive thing. The sum here, the number of derivatives is at least. The dangerous things here would be, so D is something which is 0, 2, 4, 6, because the Lorentz invariant says you have to have an even number of derivatives, and you never had inverse derivatives in the Lagrangian. So the 0 is one that you might worry about having
The thing that would be a problem here would be if this power were negative, because that would mean that we'd have something which is going like an inverse power of a low energy scale. And I'm trying to argue that the answers are all coming to you as nice powers of positive energies, positive powers of low energies divided by big energies. And so there'll have to be an argument at some point which says that this is never going to be negative. And the only thing that's at all dangerous in that argument are things coming from the scalar potential where D is zero. Any interaction with D equals two, this is dying, and then this is just two powers. So interactions with two derivatives are giving you things with two derivatives when you look at what they're generating in the effect of Lagrangian. Things with more than two derivatives are giving you things with more than two derivatives, and it depends on how many of them you use in the graph, because this V is always positive. Things in the scalar potential have to be thought about, and I'll come back to that in a bit. Those are the only things that are dangerous in this argument that low energies are never in the denominator. And this factor here is something which in the classical approximation would be one, because L would be zero. That's the graphs which have no loops in them. And every loop is being counted by a power of this product of M times Q divided by this 4 pi F squared. And so the first thing you see is that if you want the loop expansion to be a good approximation, you have to demand that this is small, because this is something which is implicitly controlling how big your loops are. And so that's showing you that this whole procedure is going to give you a controlled approximation only in the low energy limit. So I should be thinking that this Q, which was the energies of the external lines in this Wilson interaction, should be systematically smaller than everybody else. And this is quantifying how much smaller than everybody else has to be. This will also be small if Q is small, but only if this is a positive power. So the thing that everything's going to hinge on is this power here. Oh, let me write that down. So remember, Q is with much less than F, M, and V. And so loops compressed in the Wilson action by M, V, 4, pi F squared, not actually much less than 1. Small, only at M Q over 4 pi X squared is much less than 1. So that kind of is now quantifying how much smaller Q would have to be for this whole procedure to make sense. Now the other Q dependence was Q over M, the 2 sum of V minus 2 V is much less than 1. So because Q is myself M, let's make this a little bit bigger. If 2 plus sum of V minus 2 V call it from T so I can talk about it later. So D is equal to 0, 2, 4, by Lorentz invariant. So you have to come back and think about this statement again if we're not doing the Lorentz invariant thing. Only D equals 0 can produce and this is the scalar potential. And it's only going to be dangerous if it is negative. You've got the hope. If you take a particular graph, you know, L and the number of vertices are not independent of one another. And so you can make that power negative. And a way to make it negative would have been in our toy model, if we had taken the cubic, you'll see that there's another way I can write this power where you see that the things that are dangerous are the things where the couplings in the Lagrangian depend on positive powers of the mass. So in our toy Lagrangian, we had a cubic interaction L squared H whose coefficient was a mass. And I had to explicitly assume that mass was small at one point. And that's why I was making that assumption. If you had inserted that interaction many times into a graph, that's the kind of thing that can make this power negative and so ruin the low energy approximation in this kind of an amplitude. So there are specific things in the scalar potential that can make the low energy approximation break down. And what's really going on then is if you had something like that in the potential, the things that you thought were light really wouldn't be light. If you'd asked what the mass of the light field was, if you had a big mass term, big cubic interaction with a heavy term, if you have a nominally light particle and a heavy particle, and they're coupled by a cubic interaction with a big mass term in front of it, if you include loops, what you're seeing is that this light particle actually is heavy. Its mass is going to be dominated by these things that you thought were interactions, and so your whole picture as to what the spectrum was wrong. And so there are specific things like that to watch out for, but the generic situation is that most of the interactions in this Lagrangian, in particular anything with a derivative, is automatically organized in a way which is, it wants to give you things that are suppressed by the low energy divided by the heavy scale, largely because this heavy scale was appearing in the denominator in all the interactions, because the derivatives were already being, implicitly, when you wrote the Wilson action as a derivative expansion, where the derivatives were suppressed by powers of m, implicitly that expansion assumed that the momentum was smaller than m. And this is showing you that property of the Lagrangian is being inherited by loops. Loops are not ruining that. The positive powers of m's that you get in loops, because they could be ultraviolet divergent, are not really positive powers of m in dimensional regularization. Whenever I did an integral here, I was getting always a small energy scale, not a big energy scale, in my integrals. And that's essentially why this series expansion of the Wilson action in powers of momentum over m is being preserved by loops in the answers when you put it in when you talk about amplitude. So why don't we come back from have to take a break for 10 minutes or 5 minutes, because I'm going to run a little bit late. There's no thing in the afternoon, right, this week. And I'm thinking that there'll be no, next week also, I think we're going to have no lecture in the afternoon, because there's an event we have to go back to at McMaster next week. In the afternoon, but after next week, we'll go back to the old schedule of the afternoons and the morning. So I'll run a little bit late, but it was a huge long lineup for the free lunch, so I won't run as late as last time, because what defines that lineup is when all the PSI students get over here, and they get over here at 5:30, and so I'm going to aim to end at 10 after, or maybe quarter after, so remind me if I'm still going at that point to stop, and then we can all get out for lunch.